Write On Audio, the podcast for writers and all who are interested in books, literature, and the printed word. Write On Audio is the weekly companion podcast of Write On magazine and the Write On suite of publications from Pen to Print. Subscribe by searching Pen to Print in your favourite podcast app to have new editions delivered to you each week. Write On Audio interviews, inspiring you to write by sharing the experience of prominent authors. Our April interview is with author, scriptwriter, and political campaigner John O'Farrell. John's books include The Man Who Forgot His Wife and An Utterly Impartial History of Britain. His scriptwriting credits include Chicken Run, Spitting Image, and Have I Got News For You? In the 2001 general election, John stood as the no-hope Labour candidate in his hometown constituency of Maidenhead. The interviewer is Lucy Kaufman, who was alongside Write On editor Madeline White.
Well, thanks very much for doing this for us, John. This is fantastic. I was saying to Madeline that it feels quite surreal for me really interviewing you, because when your first book came out, it was something I bought my dad at the time, and it felt really close to sort of his experience as a sort of lifelong Labour supporter, doing right. the canvassing with him through the 80s and all of that, being on the doorstep, and you know, I thoroughly understood where you were coming from.
That's great, because so many people said I'd written their life story. That's what was so gratifying about that book. Everyone said, oh, I was out knocking on doors for Labour in the 80s and 90s. In fact, so many people wrote to me and said that they were supporting Labour in the 80s. I don't know how we lost so many bloody elections.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So, you know, I totally understood that kind of the false hopes of those other elections during that time, and yeah, the turkeys voting for Christmas, all of that. And also sort of, you know, shared that kind of elation in 97 that I know yeah. you as well. So what came across to me so strongly in that book is just that kind of sheer hard slog of political activism and the sort of continual lows and no real highs and the bleakness and the despair, but also the hope. And it's really hope that I really want to talk about a lot today. Yeah. That you sort of had that belief, or as an activist you kind of have to have that belief. And then sort of when I reread Things Can Only Get Worse, you kind of addressed that directly, and you used the Obama quote, or the title of his book, The Audacity of Hope. So I really wanted to sort of think today about hope and its opposite, despair, and also sort of ease and difficulty. That's sort of where I really want to sort of concentrate. So I was thinking, there's a Greta Thunberg quote where she says, we can no longer let the people in power decide what hope is. Hope is not blah, blah, blah. Hope is telling the truth. Hope is taking action. Hope always comes from the people. And I was just wondering, what action can be taken, do you think, by us, the people in 2023, and us as writers as well?
I think, yeah, there's two separate ideas there, I suppose, the activist and the writer, and I've done both. I think when you say hope is the truth, I think that's very important for writers, because it's very easy to write a book that is trying to second guess the market, or to write something you think is what your agent wants. But if you say something that's really true and maybe difficult to say, but honest and revealing about yourself and hopefully your readers, then I think that is the way forward. that brings not only sort of political hope, if that's your sort of area of writing, but also sort of spiritual hope, really, and sort of philosophical honesty, if you know what I mean. It's a hard thing to do, to go, no, that was a bad thing I thought, and to share it with the world. Well, that was a bad thing I did, and to share that with the world. But I think the world is a better place when we're honest with each other and we genuinely communicate, rather than going through the pretense of communicating, which is what Greta Thunberg means when you go blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So genuine communication, genuine honesty. I like that. That's really, really interesting. Okay. So thinking about your political activism, but also thinking about our sort of target audience for the magazine, you know, our target audience are writers who are wanting eventually to get published. What lessons can be taken from those times of despair, do you think, for the activist, but also for the writer? You know, people like me sort of plug away, trying to get somewhere and kind of, you know, possibly could give up at some point if nothing comes to fruition.
Yeah, there is a sort of a weird parallel, I suppose, between me as an activist plugging away, trying to get Labour elected, and me as an aspiring writer, you know, working on building sites and driving jobs and sending off bits of writing I'd done and getting rejections. And I suppose they both pursuits depended on the idea of hope that you're talking about and the belief that you had something to say and offer and that was worth putting out there. So I believe that a progressive government would be better for this country, and I believe that my bits of writing were worthy of sharing with other wider audience. Mm. So the alternative was just to give up and shuffle away and disappear, and I don't think anyone wants to do that.
No, that sounds really hopeful, actually, really optimistic. Yeah. I like that idea, the belief that what you have to say is worth saying.
Yeah, I mean, I think something very fundamental about human beings is the need to communicate, and writers are trying to connect with other people. And I've written TV, film, stage, newspaper columns, sketches, sitcoms. No, I could have written a spitting image sketch that communicated directly to 10 million people, but the intimacy of a book, nothing is quite as communicative as that. Nothing goes straight from the author's mind into the eyes of the reader like a book. And so I might have only sold 150, 200,000 copies of Things Going to Get Better, but the outpouring of emotion that in the letters that people wrote to me, it was like nothing else I've ever written. So to write a memoir, or sometimes with the novels, you'll get someone write to you and say, you really put your finger on something there, spoke to me so directly that that made me realise that my favourite form of writing is books, just because of the directness of the communication between writer and reader.
Yeah. I mean, there's something when I reread it recently that just made me feel less alone.
Okay.
And, you know, that I think is a wonderful thing. If a writer can make people feel less alone in their own experience, that.
Yeah, I think what was good about that book, dare I say it, was I was just so honest. And so I get mad when Labour MPs tweet, great days canvassing at Parktown Estate today. Just tweet, oh, God, it was shit today. It was, I was, no one was in and it rained. You know, we relate to you better. It's like, stop talking political speak. And, and just be human. So when I said that canvassing for the Labour Party and knocking on doors was, you know, hard and made you nervous and, you know, sometimes felt like it was a waste of time, people went, oh, God, thank God someone else felt like that as well. And so you don't have to go, it's great. Come on, give up your Sunday mornings for losing elections. So is that honesty, but humorous honesty, I suppose, is what I do. Yeah. Which makes it easier to digest, I think. That was the other USP of that book, I suppose, was that I was being
honest, but funny.
Humorously honest about how grim sometimes it is, but also how necessary.
Yeah. Okay. So in The Best a Man Can Get, you say somewhere near the end that if something is worth doing, it's going to be hard.
Yes.
And that's clearly the sentiment in Things Going to Get Better as well, isn't it, really?
Yes.
And from reading about your experiences as a comedy writer and then, you know, obviously you're with your memoir and everything, the success seemed to come to you quite easily, or it seems like that from the outside. Is that how you experienced it yourself?
It's funny. I had a period in the wilderness between university and getting my first sketches on, which felt like forever when you're in your mid-20s.
Yeah.
And if I'd gone to Cambridge or Oxford, I would have had those connections and known about the meeting at the BBC every week there where anyone could walk in, or the shows that you could send in sketches, you know, if you weren't commissioned. I didn't know, find out about those for about 4 or 5 years. So that wasn't quick. But when I started writing, I mean, I was writing with a partner, which was helpful. So the two of us writing sketches together were pretty good at that. And we got made lead writers pretty quickly on that program. And then same when the producer moved to Spitting Image. And so by the time I was 27, 28, I was the lead writer on the biggest comedy show on TV. So that is quite quick, I suppose, looking back. Mm-hmm. And then the same with when I jumped into book. Well, after that, I wrote a sitcom, mm-hmm. and that wasn't a success. And that was the first sort of shock I had of writing something and it not coming out as I'd quite imagined. Mm-hmm. We thought the scripts were funny on the page, and then I gradually realized that we had written quite an old-fashioned sitcom. We were trying to recreate 40 Towers when The Office was coming over the horizon. You know, we were still doing studio audiences and six cameras and trying to get sort of farcical plots, and tastes had moved on. And even though we were still young, we were writing something like that. So that was a shock. And it was around that time that I had the experience of writing. I had the idea for this book, Things Only Get Better. And I thought, oh, someone should write that book. It's a good idea. Oh, I should write that book. So I yeah. wrote it. And it was a big hit, as you know. And it was such a lovely experience to not have to argue with producers or get frustrated by edits or retakes or time available in the studio and all the things that had bedeviled us during the TV recordings. Mm-hmm. And it came out so exactly as I wanted it. And it went to number one and it changed my life. When people say, which book changed your life? And you're supposed to say Ulysses or, you know, Proust. That book changed my life in quite a big way. I suddenly became an author. Mm-hmm. I think it's a good book, dare I say. I think I'm allowed to say that. I think it's a good book. I think Things Can Only Get Worse is as a good book. And Things Can Only Get Better just caught a moment. So I didn't know. I thought it was a big success because it was a good book. But it's also, it was a good book. And I was very lucky at the same time that I caught the wave of how people were feeling. And it was very timely.
Yeah,
and it spoke to a lot of people. Mm. So when I had the idea for Things Can Only Get Better, the sequel, Things Can Only Get Worse, I thought, oh, great, I'm going to have all that pleasure again of people writing and the bestseller, you know, being a bestseller. And it did fine, but it wasn't a bestseller in the same way. It wasn't number one. And I just realized, oh, I was so lucky last time around. So that last book just really part of something bigger than me. It wasn't because it wasn't just because I'd written a decent book. It was because... Yeah. It was incredibly fashionable, for want of a better word.
Yeah, well, it's always like two things come together at once. Isn't it? Kind of luck meets hard work, really.
Yeah, it was luck meets hard work. And luck is often putting yourself in the right place over and over again until, you know, it strikes, until you strike gold.
Yeah. So following on from that idea of sort of ease and difficulty, reading your nonfiction and your fiction, I was struck by just how easy it seems. It just, your prose just kind of flows so beautifully. It feels like you're just talking to a friend. It feels like the spoken voice. It feels like your actual voice that you're talking to.
That's nice.
With now. And I was just wondering if the writing process does feel easy to you, or is it really hard work to make it seem that easy?
It depends. I would say easy to read, hard to write. No, it's not that easy, but I do enjoy it. There's nothing I like more than going into a scene that I know I've got to write and achieving that and looking back at the end of the day and having something that I didn't have at the beginning of the day. I prefer that to edits and tweaks and copy edit, all of that business. So I'm in the later stages of a novel at the moment, and I much prefer it when I'm creating the thing. I'd say the thing I find about a large form process like a screenplay or a stage play or a novel is I just worry so much about how it's going to end. So I'm writing this thing, I've got a vague idea of where it's heading, but the whole year that you're writing it, you're just worried about where it's going to end up. And if you are going to be able to resolve it. So you don't know. And you put all this work in. But you just keep turning up at the page and it gets better and better. Usually sometimes it goes sideways and sometimes you go down a blind alley, but it isn't. Although so I wouldn't say it's easy. I'd say it just takes a lot of time and a lot of effort, but there's lots of things you can do to help yourself and just carve out space, be kind to yourself, don't beat yourself up if you get stuck.
Yeah, but kind of a lot of fear while you're kind of writing, because I think that's something that sort of bogs me down all the time is you know, loving the project, but also kind of hating the sort of self-doubt about it.
There's a plaque that an American writer friend of mine has on his wall, which goes something like, hey, this is this idea is cool. This is great. I'm great. This is tricky. This is rubbish. I'm rubbish. And then this might be okay. And that's where you end up with this might be okay. And then you sort of, but you do go through the, this sucks, I suck point, you know, in the middle.
Yeah.
And keeping your morale, you know, up is an important part of it.
So again, sort of thinking about ease and difficulty and the challenges in people finding success, obviously there's certain sectors of society have more barriers to success than others. And traditionally, of course, the white middle-class male hasn't had so many barriers as other groups.
Yes,
and it seems to us, to Madeline and I, that there's currently a push up from unrepresented writers and voices, but also has to be a pull up from those that already have that platform. Mm-hmm. So I was just wondering, as a kind of, as a white, successful, middle-class man, what do you see as being your role in helping to pull up those less advanced groups?
This is, this is a subject close to my heart. I'm very aware of the privilege that I have enjoyed, and those meetings that I went along to at the BBC were open to everyone. You know, anybody could walk in off the street and give in their sketches to this Radio 4 Topical Comedy show, and everyone bar one was a middle-class white male graduate. And I thought, well, that's, and looking back, I go, I didn't really think about that much at the time, but all the producers that we were giving our sketches to were middle-class white male graduates. And we shared reference points, accents, background. And for the one woman in there who, you know, had to compete in this bear pit of joke shouting, it, you know, may be quite hard to come back a second time. So looking back, I know that I have, that a man will go to the front of the queue. And now, as things start to get a little bit fairer, I wouldn't say we're anywhere near there yet. So any of these men, like, I won't name names, but the people, the men who think that it's gone too far the other way, they've no idea how they continue to enjoy privilege. Mm. Now it's up to me. If rebalancing is happening, it's up to me to be exceptional and write better and better stuff that's in the way that underrepresented groups did for hundreds of years if they wanted to break through. So the onus on me now is to be that much better so that mediocre stuff doesn't get published just because of who's writing it. I do, so to actually answer your question, I do quite a lot of mentoring now. Yeah. My door is pretty open to pretty well all young people, actually. So I've done a lot of it through the London Library and the David Nobbs comedy writing competition, and meeting people one-to-one, hearing them pitch their scripts. I did this meeting to this group of about 20 shortlisted comedy writers. Mm-hmm. And I said, I will meet any of you one-to-one. If you can pitch, I won't read your novel or your screenplay. That's too much work. But I will listen to your pitch and tell you where I think it might be going wrong, or just be encouraging, or suggest that you haven't really thought about what your protagonist wants or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. But I'll do that with you on more than one occasion if that's helpful. And I said to the women in the room, women, do not think that you don't have the right to do this. Be like a pushy white man. Be like Boris Johnson in this way only. Be entitled and go, I'm going to have a grab a bit of that. And afterwards, 8 of the blokes got in touch and none of the women. And so I did a round robin again. I went, it may be that I'm just a creepy old bloke, but it might be that you think, oh, I didn't want to bother him, but do bother me. And in the end, a couple did. And I've helped with mentoring on that front and with London Library emerging writers as well.
I totally relate to that, because I mean, when I started writing plays, I got into writing plays by accident, actually. And one of the first things that I wrote as a man, I wrote with a male pseudonym.
Right.
And that was because it allowed me to be filthy and allowed me to kind of write this comedy that I wrote what I thought a man would write, actually. So I wrote it with a male pseudonym and it got taken and blah, blah, blah. And I've always found that really interesting. And another thing is that, you know, whenever I'm, you know, kind of being a woman about things and not pushing myself forward or thinking, oh, people won't want to know about my writing or people won't want to hear from me, my friend says, what would a man do?
That's what I say. What would a man do?
A man would push at this barrier. So
And men go, oh, I've only got 60% of what this job is asking for, but I'll go for it. A woman's going, I've only got 90% of what this job is offering, so I better not go for it. So, I mean, this is huge generalization. Just one other thing I'll say about your question is, in terms of underrepresented groups, it's easy to identify gender and race, but I also think class is a big issue. And I think working class voices are not being talked about enough in the same way that we are talking about diversity. When I sponsored, when I did a formal mentoring thing with my old university, they said, would you mentor a writer? And I said, yes, and forgive me if this touches any nerves of yours, but I don't know where you went to school or where you send your kids. But I said, I'm not going to do someone who went to a private school. I said, if they've already had £100,000 spent on their education, I want to help someone who didn't have that. And so send me someone who was at state school. And they were quite taken aback because Exeter's all bloody public school kids. But they found me one. And I thought, that's a better, that was a young woman, which is great. And that's, I just think that's a better use of my time as someone who's got a head start already. I don't want to help the next Boris Johnson become a writer. I want to help, someone.
Next I mean, I went to a comprehensive school and my kids went to comps. And, but recently I sent my beginning of my novel into the Penguin thing. And, and that has a sort of working class voice thing. But I agonized over that for ages, thinking, like, am I working class? I know I was working class. I know my dad was unemployed. I know that what we lived through. I know my mum had six people living, sleeping in the same bed. You know, I know the background that I've come from. But I still agonized over it. Like, now I'm educated. Now people might look at me and think I'm middle class. But I know where I've come from. I know who I am. So in the end, I did send it. But there was still that kind of feeling of like...
Well, that's the thing of, am I allowed to do this? I know I'm middle class and I know I'm privileged. And I went to comp, but I am came from a comfy background and a comfy town. And had a very, I've never, had to worry about, struggling about, the food bank. But all the more reason why it falls on people in my position to help new voices and knock on doors and try and get a different government elected.
I just thought I would share something that links to this. As I say, I can't shut up sometimes, but it's really interesting. Write On is open to anyone. So anyone can submit and get involved.
Yeah, that's good.
But what's really, really interesting is that actually you get a lot of people talking a good game and saying, oh, yes, 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 we're going to submit, we're going to be part of the team. But actually, there's very, very few people who actually stick and make it happen. And I do wonder, bearing in mind what you're talking about, whether it's a thing about confidence or whether it's actually just a thing about sticking power. And is sticking power, is that a class?
Yeah. I think it's a funny thing you say, confidence. I think being confident, which is what a white man sort of comes, hardwired, means that they might be better at sticking with the, doesn't make any sense at all, but sticking with the things that I've been talking about. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know, because I feel like when people have come from, they've had very little, I think they have a lot of hunger. I think they have a lot of drive.
Yeah.
A lot of perseverance through hardship and through challenge. So I don't know, but definitely confidence is something you get at public school.
Or just being, a 6 foot tall white man just gives me, when I walk to a bar, I can feel the barman making eye contact with me ahead of the woman. She was first. And it's but that happens in every area, so you just have to be aware of it and be aware of your privilege. Make sure that you give back. And again, that's an easy thing to talk about, and I shouldn't go on about it too much because I don't do quite enough of it, but I do it. I generally say yes, and this is an invitation for every reader of Write On to say, I've written a novel, will you read it? Young writers who've had a credit and have come to me via the Emerging Writers or the other, National Film and Television School, which I've done some stuff for, I will meet them and listen to them. And that's easy for me to do.
Okay. So it's clear throughout your writing that you're a dad and you've got children who are now grown up and are kind of forging their own way in the world. So as elder generations, we often put all our hope into the next generations and into the young. And you have hope in young people. And what do you think you and we as activists or writers can pass on to these new generations?
I do have enormous amount of hope in the next generation. Perhaps I'm basing that on my own kids. But that was really, you know, coming out of the experience of my own children, that's how I ended Things Are Going to Get Worse, was a sense of hope that this generation were smart, informed, passionate, and resolved to, you know, work miracles. I mean, they're going to need some miracles because we haven't left the world in a very easy place for them. But no, I do feel inspired by the commitment of young political activists and the individuals that I see fighting their battles. I mean, sometimes I despair that we haven't come further. I thought some of the feminist battles of the 70s and 80s had been won, and I see my daughter having to fight the same fights all over again, which I find demoralizing and baffling. There was a sense in the noughties that young people weren't interested in politics. And I remember my son's, because my son, you know, he was like sixth form, but very political. He said, "It's so unfashionable, Dad." And then by 10 years later, you know, it all changed. And I think, you know, the post-Brexit, post-Trump, maybe even before that, I think people feel passionate about politics again in all its forms.
Definitely, because it's really affecting people. I mean,
yeah, they can see that they
at the moment.
Yeah, they can see they've got to, and they can't inherit the world as it is.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. So what are you particularly hopeful about, or what are you currently despairing of?
Well, that's a big question. I'm hopeful about the capacity for young people to find new ways of communicating, offering ideas and hope, and showing compassion and kindness to one another, and finding new models of politics that perhaps will replace the old worn out methods that we, you know, that we used of door knocking and petitioning and marching that only get you so far.
Okay, good.
Despairing, I don't really want to embrace my despair.
No.
I mean, there are times when you feel despair after, you know, after Boris Johnson got back in again with a huge majority. I felt like we might be out for even longer than we had been under Thatcher and Major. And so that was a very, very scary prospect for me.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I hope's what gets me up in the morning, I think. So I'm feeling less. I mean, I wrote Things Are Going to Get Worse after the 2017 election, and there was a moment of hope when Theresa May had lost a majority. And then the people who bought it after 2019 go, "Love the book, John, but ending on hope? What were you thinking?" Because it was like, Boris Johnson has got a majority of 80. How can you feel this hope? And it was like, sorry about that.
Yeah, I was wondering if the next one's going to be called Things Get Even Worse.
Well, we'll see. Who knows? About three of the trilogy are going to be like Star Wars, and I'll find out that Donald Trump's actually my father.
Oh, gosh. That'd be interesting. Okay, so, I've got a question sort of around this sort of Trump-Boris Johnson era here. Reading those books again, and I was sort of reminded again of that evolution of our political landscape from the early 80s right through to Trump, and how people have said that Trump and the Boris Johnson era have been difficult to satirize. Because who can satirize something that is already satire? So I was wondering what you think the role of comedy and satire is now in helping to bring about political change. Because I know you've sort of talked about how the role of comedy and satire isn't what you used to think it was, that you now sort of believe that. Yeah.
Well, when I was writing for Spitting Image in the 80s and 90s, there was still a certain sense that our politicians and royals were up there on a pedestal, and they needed a little bit of pulling off that pedestal. Yeah, I think the sort of automatic reverence has gone until we got to the stage where people like Boris Johnson and Donald Trump come pre-satirized. They there's nothing we could put in the mouth of Trump or Johnson as a joke that would be anything more outrageous than things they've said themselves. But I think there's a role for satire to hold up a distorting mirror to different areas of the way. So I love the way that a show like The Thick of It showed the people behind the politicians. There are great creative things online from people like Led by Donkeys, where it's not full on impressionist of Boris Johnson or Liz Truss or Rishi Sunak doing voices and putting words in their mouths. It's a bit more sophisticated and clever now to get behind the motivation and the real issues. So satire evolves, but I just don't think it's this, you know, I don't think it's the same as it was when I was doing it for Radio 4 or for...
So it's not just poking fun anymore or kind of...
Yeah, I think
them up to be buffoons anymore. It's more than that. It's clever.
Yeah. My writing will always be political, I think. I can't really help it. The idea of writing a sketch where Rishi Sunak is talking to Liz Truss just doesn't interest me at all anymore. I know, maybe it should. Maybe it's just I've been done that already in my past. But yeah, I'd rather write about, you know, where the real power is. Write about things that ordinary people experience or relate to. I feel like poking fun at politicians themselves is only gets you so far.
I think you said on Newsnight that satire serves the establishment. Do you still sort of believe that? Do you still think?
Yeah, I mean, that was a deliberately provocative statement for the sake of their contrary format they had there. But I think there's an element of truth that satire, in a way, is a release valve, and laughing at politicians, you know, processes the anger and the outrage. Maybe that diffuses the intensity of feeling that might otherwise lead to revolution. I mean, it's a bold claim, but I think there's something in it. I think there's a... You know, where you aren't allowed to laugh, eventually you turn to violence instead. You know, processing strong feelings can be done in different ways. And I think having a chuckle at the people above us is better than throwing petrol bombs.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like that happened recently sort of on Twitter, and that there was a kind of realization that, hold on a minute, protest doesn't seem to work anymore. And we felt particularly helpless because all our old systems of counteracting what was going on no longer sort of had any power, really. And I guess comedy and satire is in that camp at the moment of sort of, yeah, we can do all these things, but it's not really changing anything.
I don't think comedy or satire ever changed anything, really. I think they say that the only satire that ever worked was Smashy and Nicey. But no Thatcher government was brought down by Arse-Spitting Image sketches. But, you know, when Peter Cook opened the Establishment Club in 1962, he said he hoped it would, he was inspired by the great success of the Berlin Cabaret in opposing Adolf Hitler. You know, so he was very self-aware about the limited power of satire. I think it makes you feel better along the way to have a good laugh, and it raises morale, and it sometimes can crystallize a feeling about a politician or a policy, but no government was ever brought down by a joke or jokes.
No. I mean, I saw an interview recently with Billy Bragg, and he was saying that he now knows that music isn't going to change the world, and that was something that he used to believe in.
I think it does, actually. But I mean, I think it shapes the conversation. So I think that, you know, is important. And I think it's like music, like jokes, like novels, they shape the discourse, and they expand your possibilities and your imagination. I think that does, in its own little way, change the world.
Okay. What hope do you think there is for artists to change the world at the moment?
It's impossible to measure. But I suppose you just got to keep trying. I think... just to gain a greater understanding of where we are in this, you know, rapidly changing world. If art, writing and painting and all those things that we do were not powerful, then dictatorships wouldn't suppress them. Then it would be legal to write whatever you wanted in Iran or North Korea. So we must have influence and power, because totalitarian governments won't allow it. And so it's a vital part of our democracy that we exercise those powers and we use them fully and responsibly.
So we're more powerful than we realize, maybe.
I think we're more thought. I think you can, you know, the artists lead the way in a society. They're the first to identify the issues and the problems and potential solutions in creative ways. And often the politicians and the voters have their eyes opened and their imaginations fired up by fiction and nonfiction.
Okay.
I naively hope. I think it's true. I mean, this includes, I include films in this as well, of course. You know, I don't, you know.
Yeah, it feels true.
Yeah.
True. Okay, so what future projects do you have in mind? Obviously, you're a very versatile writer, Chicken Run, the musical, the sitcoms, the sketches.
Yeah, I don't have any. I have a novel, which I'm just finishing. That'll be out in early 23, I think. No, we are 23, early 24.
Uh-huh.
And that's quite political and sort of funny as well, I hope. I'm writing on I'm working on a third musical, which I'm writing on my own this time. I can't tell you what that is just yet, but that's been commissioned. I've written a play. I'm not quite sure what to do with it. That's the first bit of spec writing I've done for 30 years, actually. Mm-hmm. I had a reading of it with some actors and it went quite well. But I still don't know what to do with it.
My brother, he produces.
Well, I've got a producer I handed it to, so it's got someone sort of connected to it already.
Okay, okay.
It was interesting to write something on spec, actually, because I had the time during lockdown and stuff. Mm-hmm. So yeah, and I do a podcast, of course. I do a comedy podcast, history podcast with Angela Barnes.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, after this, I just hopefully another book after this novel that I'm finishing. I haven't decided whether it's going to be fiction or nonfiction. I've got the musical, Chicken Run 2 is coming out at the end of 2023. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I've got plenty, plenty of things to be going. Also, I've got to sort of oversee the American tour of Mrs. Doubtfire, so I'll be going back out there for that. And then after that, there'll be a British tour. So there's casting stuff to do and potential rewrites. So it's never boring. There's always something to do. And I'm sort of finding myself jumping between projects at the moment. But I do want to sit down at some point in the summer and go, right, what's the next book going to be after this one? When I've finally parked that piece of work.
Okay, excellent. So I was just wondering, sort of as a comedy writer and satirist, how do you plan to go forward in terms of kind of staying adaptive to the changing political and social landscapes and the sort of shifting sounds of the future of comedy and satire?
I don't know if I am going to be at the cutting edge of that in the way I was in my 20s and 30s, because I'm just not as finely tuned in, you know, into the world of music and the internet as someone like my daughter, who's like a internet cartoonist with sort of six times as many followers as me. I'll find a way of expressing the voice of my generation, I suppose, and try and speak, make it a universal, try and write universal stories. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll write something historical. I haven't decided. I feel like I should try something a bit more challenging. Doesn't mean don't be funny, but I don't want to keep writing the same book again. Do you know what I mean? I saw that David Bowie documentary last night, and he said an artist should walk out in the water, and when they're just out of their depth, that's where they'll produce their best work.
Thank you to John O'Farrell for being the subject of our interview. As usual, we'll publish links so you can find out more about John in the show notes for this podcast. We're always delighted to read your contributions. So if you'd like to see your words in Write On or hear them on this podcast, please get in touch. We'll share this link and all others mentioned in today's podcast as part of our show notes. I've been Tiffany Clare, and you've been listening to Write On Audio. Write on Audio is produced by Chris Gregory, and it's an alternative stories production for Pen to Print. This podcast is supported using public funding by Arts Council England.